The assassination of President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, remains one of the most debated moments in American history. Conspiracy theories abound, with various factions believing the truth has yet to be uncovered. But in a twist that few saw coming, a new subject has cracked the case wide open: the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. While his death is often overshadowed by Kennedy's assassination, it may hold the key to unraveling a mystery that's haunted the nation for more than half a century. But was Tippit's murder really a coincidence, or is there more to it? J.D. Tippit, a 39-year-old patrolman in the Dallas Police Department, was shot and killed about 45 minutes after JFK was assassinated. Tippit's death occurred in the Oak Cliff neighborhood of Dallas, under what many believe are suspicious circumstances. Tippit, who had been directed by radio to patrol certain areas in response to the unfolding events, encountered a man near East 10th Street and Patton Avenue, whom he suspected to be involved in the earlier shooting of the president. What followed was nothing short of chilling. Tippit was shot 4 times by Lee Harvey Oswald, the same man later accused of assassinating JFK. But here's where the plot thickens. Could Tippit's death be part of something bigger? Was Oswald just following orders, or was he a patsy, a fall guy in a much deeper conspiracy? The idea that Tippit's murder was connected to JFK's assassination has long been debated, and new evidence continues to emerge, shedding new light on this tragic event. Over the years, several theories have emerged suggesting that Tippit's death may not have been a simple case of a man fleeing the scene of an assassination. In fact, some believe that Tippit was targeted because he was either involved in the conspiracy or simply at the wrong place at the wrong time. Some conspiracy theorists argue that Tippit's death was part of a larger conspiracy to kill JFK. According to this theory, Tippit may have been in the wrong place when Oswald spotted him. Was Tippit murdered to tie up loose ends and prevent him from sharing crucial information about the assassination plot? Some even suggest that Tippit's murder was a calculated move to frame Oswald for both the killing of the president and the police officer, creating a seemingly irrefutable case for Oswald's guilt. On the flip side, many believe that Oswald shot Tippit in panic as he was fleeing the scene after the assassination of JFK. According to this line of thinking, Oswald knew that he was being pursued and acted out of self-preservation. After all, the police were all on high alert, and Oswald had likely realized that he was going to be arrested for the murder of the president. The shooting of Tippit might have been a desperate attempt to escape his imminent capture. New revelations surrounding witness testimonies and evidence handling have raised more questions than answers. For example, multiple witnesses at the scene reported seeing 2 men near Tippit's police car, but only one was ever identified as Oswald. Some even suggest that Oswald was not the shooter at all, and that Tippit's murder was part of a larger conspiracy to cover up the true assassins behind both the president's death and Tippit's own. The case was further complicated by the testimony of Helen Markham, one of the key witnesses to the shooting. Markham identified Oswald as the shooter during a police lineup, but her testimony was far from bulletproof. In fact, some argue that Markham's identification of Oswald was coerced or even fabricated to ensure that Oswald was charged with Tippit's murder. This has led some researchers to suggest that other individuals may have been involved in both crimes, and Tippit's murder could have been an attempt to silence him before he could speak out about what he knew. Interestingly, some investigators have raised the possibility that Tippit may have been involved in a deeper plot to protect Oswald. The notion that Oswald was a government asset or spy working for another entity, such as the CIA or Mafia, has been floated in certain circles. Was Tippit aware of Oswald's role in the assassination, and was he murdered to prevent him from revealing the truth about who was really behind the death of President Kennedy? Some believe that Tippit, like Oswald, was simply another pawn in a larger game played by shadowy figures within the government, organized crime, or even foreign intelligence services. Was Oswald forced into the role of assassin, or did he actively participate in a conspiracy he didn't fully understand? For those who still question the official narrative, the idea that Oswald was involved in a conspiracy is not just about the president's assassination, but also Tippit's murder. Some researchers, like Jim Garrison, the district attorney from New Orleans, have suggested that the death of Tippit was deliberately connected to the larger assassination cover-up. Was Tippit's death not just about an alleged escape attempt, but a deliberate plan to shift blame to Oswald? Could it be that Oswald was framed not just for JFK's murder, but also for Tippit's, with the Warren Commission working to cover up a larger conspiracy? Many believe that Tippit's death was an important part of the machinations designed to ensure that the real conspirators behind the assassination remained hidden. J.D. Tippit, a decorated police officer who had served bravely in World War II, left behind a legacy as a fallen hero, but his death may have been far from accidental. As new details emerge, questions about his role in the larger Kennedy assassination continue to resurface. Was Tippit just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or was he a victim of something much bigger than he could have ever imagined? As witness testimonies continue to be re-examined and new evidence surfaces, it's clear that the mystery surrounding J.D. Tippit's death may hold the final piece to the puzzle of the JFK assassination. With new theories being proposed by experts and amateur researchers alike, one thing is certain: the truth is still out there, and Tippit's murder might just be the key to unlocking it. With so many questions still left unanswered, the murder of J.D. Tippit will continue to be a crucial point in understanding the mysteries of that fateful day in Dallas. As more researchers dive into the case, it's possible that the truth behind both Kennedy's assassination and Tippit's tragic death will finally come to light. For now, theories, both credible and bizarre, will continue to swirl around these pivotal events in American history.
Welcome to The End of Innocence, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I'm your host, John Young, and welcome to part two of the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. In last week's episode, we looked at why Officer Tippit was patrolling Oak Cliff that day, and why some of his movements and his behavior that day are very confusing. Did he lie to his dispatcher about where he was that day just moments before he was fatally shot? What's up with the phone call at Top 10 Records? And maybe the biggest question of all, just moments before his own death, why did Tippit in his patrol car cut off insurance salesman James Andrews and search the back seat of his car without saying a word to Andrews? I would suggest if you missed last week's episode, go back and listen before moving ahead in our series. In the episodes ahead, we'll dig into the murky details surrounding that afternoon. We'll examine some of the critical questions of what happened that day at the corner of 10th and Patton in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. Today's episode dives into first-hand accounts from those who witnessed the moment surrounding Officer J.D. Tippit's tragic death. What did they see, and how do their stories shape our understanding of that day? What did eyewitnesses say about the shooter? What exactly happened during that brief and fatal encounter between Tippit and his killer? And perhaps most importantly, did anyone actually identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the gunman? We're on a mission to find out, did Lee Harvey Oswald kill Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit?
Unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle.
We're somebody shooting out here. It's a police officer. Somebody shot him. What's it? 4 10th Street.
78.
It's in a police car.
Number 10.
Number 10. He's dead.
This is what the Warren Report says about the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. Quote, at approximately 1:15 p.m., Officer J.D. Tippit pulled up alongside a man walking in the same direction that Tippit was driving. The man met the general description of the suspect wanted in connection with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He walked over to Tippit's car, rested his arms on the door on the right side of the car, and apparently exchanged words with Tippit through the window. Tippit opened the door on the left side and started to walk around the front of his car. As Tippit reached the front wheel on the driver's side, the man on the sidewalk drew a revolver and fired several shots in rapid succession, hitting Tippit 4 times and killing him instantly. End quote.
Send all squads for information. We have report that an officer has been involved in a shooting in the 400 block of East 10th.
The Warren Report concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was responsible for the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit, citing 4 key pieces of evidence to support his findings. According to the Warren Commission, those key pieces of evidence are, quote, number 1, 2 eyewitnesses saw the Tippit shooting, and 7 eyewitnesses heard the shots and saw the gunman leave the scene with revolver in hand. These 9 eyewitnesses positively identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the man they saw. Number 2. The cartridge cases found at the scene of the shooting were fired from the revolver in the possession of Lee Harvey Oswald at the time of his arrest, to the exclusion of all other weapons. Number 3. The revolver in Oswald's possession at the time of his arrest was purchased by and belonged to Oswald. And number 4. Oswald's jacket was found along the path of the flight taken by the gunman as he fled from the scene of the killing. End quote. The Warren Commission makes it sound like an open and shut case, but it isn't. That's what makes this moment in American history so endlessly compelling. On paper, the Warren Report makes a tight case. Clear timeline, physical evidence, multiple witnesses. But as you peel back the layers, contradictions begin to surface. Eyewitness accounts that don't quite match. Questions about Oswald's movements. Uncertainties about Tippit's presence in Oak Cliff to begin with. What starts as open and shut might just open up a dozen new questions. First of all today, we're going to look at what witnesses actually said that somewhat support the Warren Commission's findings that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Officer J.D. Tippit. The Tippit murder took place near the intersection of Patton Avenue and East 10th Street. Patton runs north to south, while 10th Street crosses it east to west. Just one block south, Patton meets Jefferson Boulevard, one of the area's main arteries. About 6 blocks west along Jefferson sits the Texas Theater, the site of Lee Harvey Oswald's dramatic arrest shortly after Tippit's shooting. With the streets of Oak Cliff now fresh in our minds, it's time to examine the people who were there. Those who claim to have seen the man who gunned down Officer Tippit on November 22, 1963. In the minutes after the shots rang out, neighbors stepped out onto front porches, peered through windows, and rushed to the scene. Some saw a man fleeing. Others watched from just feet away. Their stories became the backbone of the Warren Report's case against Lee Harvey Oswald. But even decades later, they raise as many questions as they answer. So what did they see? Who did they describe? And how do their accounts hold up today? The so-called star witness for the Warren Commission is Helen Markham. She was at the corner of East 10th and Patton as she was on her way to the bus stop at the corner of Patton and Jefferson Avenue. Here's Helen Markham in her own words to describe what she saw that day.
He got out of the car, slow motion. He calmly crawled out of his car, and he started around to the front of the car. And just as he got even with the front wheel on the driver's side, this man shot him 3 times in the wink of your eye. And then he turned, and he was fooling with this gun, and he came back down 10th Street toward me. And he saw me, he stopped. And he looked at me, I looked at him, and he was furious. His eyes were big, and of course mine were too. And all it was, I put my hands above my face like this, real tight, closed my eyes, and I stood there. And then I opened my fingers, opened my eyes, and gradually pulled them down. Well, I don't know what happened to him, but he just went off in a little trot across the vacant lot out here. And then the police came. They take me down to the city hall. And, of course, they got the statement. And then I identified him in the lineup.
Markham's testimony helped shape the official narrative. But critics note that her statements changed slightly over time, and that her reliability has been questioned by some researchers. For example, when Helen Markham testified before the Warren Commission, she recalled first seeing the man who would later shoot Officer J.D. Tippit as he was walking south along Patton Avenue, heading away from her towards 10th Street. A police car slowly approached, easing up behind him. Markham described the cruiser as, quote, driving real slow, while the man continued walking at an unhurried pace. Eventually, the car pulled to the curb and came to a stop, and so did the man. She remembered the man walking over, quote, very slow, leaning in through the car's window with his arms resting on the ledge, as if speaking with someone he knew, end quote. In her eyes, it appeared to be a calm, almost friendly exchange, but that calm shattered in seconds. According to Markham, the man suddenly stepped back as Tippit began to open the driver's side door. What happened next echoed what Domingo Benavides would later testify. The man fired, striking Tippit as he tried to move around the front of his car. Something that has never made sense is Helen Markham claimed that she was alone with Officer Tippett's body for 20 minutes after the shooting. That directly contradicts multiple witness accounts, which placed several bystanders at the scene almost immediately. She also said Tippit tried to speak to her, but she couldn't make out his words. Yet the medical evidence and every other eyewitness suggest Tippit died instantly. It's moments like these where facts, memory, and perception blur that make separating truth from confusion so challenging. And it begs the question, was Helen Markham a flawed but sincere witness? Or was her testimony shaped by trauma, time, or something else entirely? The closest witness to the shooting was Domingo Benavides. You would think that would have made him the star witness for the Warren Commission. But listen carefully and you'll find out why he wasn't.
As I was driving down the street, I seen this police car was sitting here, and the officer was getting out of the car and apparently had been talking to the man that was standing by the car. The policeman got out of the car, and as he walked past the windshield of the car where they'd kind of lined up over the hood of the car, well, then this other man shot him. And of course he was reaching for his gun. And I stand there, you know, sitting there in the truck and not in no big hurry to get out. Of course I was sitting there watching everything. This man turned from the car then and took a couple steps. Then as he turned to walk away, he was unloading his gun, and he took the shells, held them in his hand, and as he took off, he threw them in the bushes, more or less like not really trying to get rid of them. I guess he didn't figure he was caught anyway, so he just threw them in the bushes. But as he started to turn and walk away, he stopped and looked back at me, and I didn't know if he figured, well, I'll just let this poor guy go, or he has nothing to do with it, or, you know, I'm not out to kill everybody, just, you know, whoever gets in my way, I guess. I give him enough time to get around the house, thinking he might have went in the house. I sat there for maybe a second or two, and then jumped out of the truck and run over. As I walked by, I didn't even slow down. I see the officer dead, so I just walked in, got in the car, and I figured that would be the fastest way. In fact, I don't even know why I called him on the radio. I just figured now that it was the fastest way to get a police officer out.
Hello, police operator. Go ahead. Go ahead, it says news and you get
police. Hello, we've heard a shooting out here.
What is it at? It says the news and police radio. What location?
Between Los Angeles and Buckley. It's a police officer. Somebody shot him.
It's
in a police car.
Number 10.
Hello, police officer. Did you get that?
Police officer, 510 East Jefferson.
Thank you.
35.
A citizen using police radio will remain off the radio now.
Well, now, did several other people come up later?
Immediately afterwards. I mean, it was just... Oh, after people right there, it's a block away, like Mr. Calloway, he come up and he says, let's go get him or something. And then this cab pulled up right afterwards. And so Calloway went over and took the guns, officer's gun, out of his hand.
But Calloway did go after him, didn't he?
Yeah, Calloway took off to go try to catch him.
Benavides was right there, closer than anyone else when Tippett was gunned down. He was only 15 feet away from the police car when he saw the gunman turn and walk back to the sidewalk. He watched the entire event unfold through the windshield of his pickup truck. He would later tell investigators that he saw the suspect fire at Tippett, walk calmly away, and discard bullet casings as he fled. But despite his proximity and detailed recollections, Benavides wasn't treated as a star witness you might expect. Why? Well, for starters, he never possibly identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the gunman. He described the shooter as a young white male, generally fitting Oswald's description, but said he didn't get a clear enough view of the face to feel confident pointing someone out in a lineup. That clashed with the Warren Commission's broader narrative, which relied heavily on firmer identifications. Even more telling, Benavides declined to testify before the commission in person. Instead, his written affidavit and FBI reports were entered into the record. According to some reports, he feared for his safety, a reminder of just how tense and uncertain the atmosphere was in the wake of the assassination. There's also a strange postscript. Benavides' own brother was murdered not long after the Kennedy assassination. Some researchers had speculated that the killing may have been a warning or could have been mistaken identity, as Domingo and his brother looked strikingly similar. So here we have someone with the clearest view of the Tippett shooting, but whose testimony ends up muffled, underplayed, almost lost in the larger story. So what did some of the other witnesses say? Virginia Davis lived at 404 East 10th Street and was one of the key witnesses in the immediate vicinity of Officer J.D. Tippett's murder. She and her sister-in-law, Barbara Davis, were inside their home on East 10th Street when they heard the gunshots. Rushing to the front door, they saw a man fleeing the scene with a gun in his hand. Virginia, who was 16 years old when she testified to the Warren Commission, said she heard two shots from inside her apartment. Then she opened the door and saw Helen Markham screaming, quote, "He shot him. He is dead. Call the police," end quote. Virginia testified that she saw the man cutting across her yard and emptying shell casings from his revolver as he ran. She described him as a white male wearing a light-colored jacket, details that generally align with other witness accounts. The Davis sisters later found two shell casings on their lawn, which were turned over to the police and became part of the physical evidence in the case. While Virginia Davis didn't witness the actual shooting, her account of the suspect's flight and the recovery of the shell casings helped bolster the Warren Commission's timeline and narrative. Jimmy Burt, who lived on East 10th Street near the scene of Officer J.D. Tippett's murder, was sitting on his porch with a friend when they heard two gunshots. He said he heard four more shots as he got in his car to see what was happening. Within seconds, he and his friend William Smith drove their 1952 two-tone Ford just a half a block to the site of the shooting. Burt says he caught a glimpse of the man running down 10th Street and then south on Patton Avenue going towards Jefferson Boulevard. All he could make out was the guy had a white shirt on. They were among the first people to arrive after J.D. Tippett was shot. But here's the twist. Despite their proximity, Burt and Smith didn't immediately report what they had saw. Burt was AWOL from the U.S. Army, and Smith was on probation for Grand Theft Auto. Fearing legal consequences, they kept quiet, at least at first. Later, Burt reportedly shared that he saw the aftermath of the shooting, though the details of what he actually witnessed remained vague in the official record. His delayed involvement in legal status may have contributed to why his account wasn't emphasized by the Warren Commission. Another man close to the shooting that day was cab driver William Scoggins, who was parked near the intersection of 10th Street and Patton Avenue, eating his lunch in his cab, when he saw Tippett's patrol pull up and a man approach it. He heard three or four shots in quick succession. However, his view of the actual shooting was partially obstructed by hedges, so he didn't witness the shots being fired directly. What he did see and what made his testimony significant was the gunman fleeing the scene and walk right past his cab on Patton Avenue. Scoggins described a young white man with a gun in hand walking past his cab. Fearing for his life, Scoggins ducked down behind his vehicle. He heard the man utter the words, "Poor damn cop," or "Poor dumb cop," as he passed by Scoggins' cab. Later at a police lineup, Scoggins identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the man he saw walk past his cab with a gun in hand. Scoggins' account helped reinforce the timeline of events and supported other witness descriptions of the suspect's escape. Still, the fact that he didn't see the actual shooting has led some to view his testimony as supportive, but not definitive. Ted Calloway, a used car salesman working just a block south of the Tippit shooting, told the Warren Commission he heard 5 distinct pistol shots. Stepping outside, he spotted a man running across Patton Avenue, moving from the east side to the west, with a pistol clutched in his right hand. Calloway didn't just stand by. As the man passed him, he called out, quote, "Hey man, what the hell is going on?" End quote. The man said nothing, continuing westward down Jefferson Boulevard without breaking stride. Here's an interview with Ted Calloway done later that evening.
"I was sitting in my office when I heard what sounded to be 5 pistol shots coming from behind my office in the direction of 10th Street. Well, I jumped up, ran out to the sidewalk, and as I did, I saw a man jump through the hedge carrying a pistol, and he angled across the street to the sidewalk and continued to run in my direction, holding his pistol. When he got almost directly across from me, I yelled at him, 'Hey man, what the hell is going on?' And he had his pistol right here, and he nearly stopped, and he turned in my direction and said something, but I couldn't understand what he said. So he continued walking down Patton Street. I called to a friend of mine. I said, 'Follow that guy, see where he's going.'"
Jack Tatum was driving westbound on 10th Street, just seconds ahead of Domingo Benavidez, when he passed a scene that would soon erupt in violence. As he crossed the intersection near Patton Avenue, he noticed a man standing beside a police cruiser, Officer J.D. Tippit still seated inside. Moments later, Tatum heard 3 gunshots. He immediately stopped his car and turned to look back. What Tatum saw next was seared into his memory. The man approached Tippit, who was now lying on the ground, and fired a fatal shot, point blank, into Tippett's head. Tatum's account is one of the few that describes his final execution-style shot. It added a grim detail to the official narrative and helped shape the Warren Commission's understanding of the sequence of events. Yet, like so many other elements of the Tippit case, it also raised questions about timing, positioning, and how such a close-range act could have unfolded in broad daylight with so many eyes nearby. Here's Jack Tatum in his own words.
"I was preparing to turn left on 10th Street from Denver. I noticed an individual walking in my direction with a light zipper jacket on, darker pants, and a squad car pulling over to the curb next to him. As I approached the squad car, I noticed that that individual was leaning over talking to the officer, and he had both hands in the pockets of his jacket. I continued through the intersection, and about in the middle of the intersection, I heard 3, maybe 4 shots. He then looked around, surveyed the situation, and started a slow run toward my direction. I put my car in gear and drove forward and watched him through the rearview mirror. I saw him very clearly and realized that there was one thing that made him stand out, and that was his mouth that curled up. I couldn't mistake that.
Kind of a smile.
Yes, kind of a smile. And I was within 10, 15 feet of that individual, and it was Lee Harvey Oswald."
From the overlapping testimony of several key witnesses, we began to assemble a sequence of events. The shooter was first seen by Helen Markham walking east on 10th Street along the right side of the road. Moments later, Officer J.D. Tippit slowly pulled his patrol car to the same side of the street, stopping roughly 4 feet from the curb. The man stopped walking, turned back, and leaned into the window of Tippett's car. To Markham, the interaction seemed calm, almost friendly. But the mood shifted instantly. Tippin opened the car door and began to walk around the front of his cruiser, possibly to speak more directly with the man. That's when the gunfire erupted. The shooter fired several shots, striking Tippit before he could clear the front wheel. Then, in a final chilling moment, He stepped forward and delivered a point-blank shot to Tippett's head as the officer lay dying on the pavement, an act described in haunting detail by Jack Tatum. The gunman fled westward, running past cab driver William Scoggins through Virginia Davis's front yard, where he discarded spent shell casings, and past Ted Calloway, who stood outside of his used car lot just a block away. The man then turned right onto Jefferson Boulevard, heading in the direction of the Texas Theater. After combing through the Warren report, we realize something. It leaves a lot unsaid. That's why we turn to the witness statements themselves. Our key question, whether Oswald was quickly identified, and if those IDs were based on lineups that met any real standard of fairness. What we found out might surprise you. Domingo Benavides was the closest witness to the scene when Officer J.D. Tippett was shot. If anyone might have gotten a good look at the killer, it was him. But here's the twist. Benavides didn't identify Oswald. In fact, he told Dallas police straight up that he didn't think he could make a reliable ID. And it gets even more interesting. He never even took part in a police lineup. Which begs the question, if the best eyewitness couldn't or wouldn't ID Oswald, how much weight should we give the ones who did? When the Warren Commission finally interviewed Domingo Benavides, something curious came up. Even though he hadn't identified anyone to the Dallas police, he did refer to the shooter as Oswald. That caught the commission's attention. Counsel David Bellin pressed him, why use Oswald's name if he couldn't ID him back then? Benavides gave a telling answer. He'd seen Oswald's face on TV and in newspapers nearly every day for a month after the shooting. So by the time of the interview, that face had practically burned itself into his mind. The implication? It wasn't recognition from memory. It was familiarity from repetition. Then there's Helen Markham, often cited as the second closest eyewitness to the Tippett shooting. In her affidavit to the Dallas police, she said she was just 50 feet away when it happened. And crucially, she identified Lee Harvey Oswald in a police lineup. Case closed, right? Well, not exactly. Critics of the Warren report point to an odd and uncomfortable exchange during her Warren Commission testimony. When Commission Counsel Joseph Ball pressed her about the lineup, her answers were scattered. At one point, she seemed unsure whether she had picked Oswald because she recognized him or because someone told her which number to choose. The transcript reads more like a nervous recollection than a clear, confident ID. For those skeptical of the official story, this wasn't just a shaky moment on the witness stand. It was a major red flag. Here's some of her questioning. Counsel Ball, now when you went into the room, you looked these people over, these four men? Markham says, yes, sir. Ball says, did you recognize anyone in that lineup? Markham says, no, sir. Ball, did you recognize anybody from their face? Markham, from their face? No. Ball, did you identify any of these four people? Helen Markham, I didn't know anybody. I had never seen none of them. Ball, was there a number two man there? Markham, number two is the one I picked. Number two was the man I saw shoot the policeman. I looked at him. When I saw this man, I wasn't sure, but I had cold chills run all over me when I saw him. Number two was Lee Harvey Oswald. Helen Markham's testimony was a roller coaster, and not the kind the Warren Commission wanted to ride. At several points in her interview, she flat out denied recognizing any of the men in the lineup. Then, after being prompted about number two, she recalled picking him. Not because she recognized him, but because, in her words, she felt chills. It was more of a gut feeling than a clear visual ID. That kind of shaky recall didn't go unnoticed. Commission Counsel Joseph Ball later referred to Markham as, quote, an utter screwball, end quote, and described her testimony as full of mistakes and utterly unreliable. And yet, Markham still told the commission she recognized Oswald mostly from his face and insisted it was the same man that she saw at the scene. So how do you reconcile that? A witness who fluctuates between certainty and confusion, intuition and identification? For critics of the official narrative, it raises a critical point. Was Markham's identification credible, or was it simply what investigators needed it to be? Virginia Davis was another key witness. She saw the man with the gun run through her front yard, and she later identified that man as Lee Harvey Oswald in a police lineup. So that sounds pretty definite, but here's where things get complicated. Davis also described the other men in the lineup. One was tall and slim, two were chubby and short, and one was medium tall. Compared to Oswald's build, that kind of physical variety raised eyebrows. Critics of the Warren Report argued that this was no fair lineup, that Oswald stuck out like a sore thumb. In their eyes, it wasn't just about recognition, it was about who looked out of place. Still, Davis made a positive ID. She believed the man she saw with the gun was Oswald. So the question becomes, was that identification a genuine recognition based on memory, or was it nudged by a lineup's design? And then there's William Scoggins, a cab driver who happened to be eating his lunch near the scene when Officer Tippett was gunned down. Scoggins saw a man flee the area and later identified that man as Lee Harvey Oswald in a police lineup. Unlike some of the other witnesses, Scoggins seemed certain. Oswald, he said, was the man who ran past him, gun in hand. His identification bolstered the case against Oswald, but it didn't come without its own set of questions. Was the lineup fair? Was Scoggins' vantage point close enough? Or was his confidence, shaped like others, by the days of seeing Oswald's face splashed across television screens and front pages? Still, Scoggins' ID adds another layer to the puzzle. Alongside Davis and Markham, he becomes part of a trio of witnesses who pointed to Oswald. But as we've already seen, when it comes to eyewitnesses, certainty isn't always clarity. Then there's Ted Calloway, a witness who said he saw the gunman fleeing and later picked out Oswald in the lineup. He wasn't close. He estimated the distance at 56 feet, which he measured afterwards. But he said the man in the lineup looked like the one he saw running with the gun in his hand. On its face, that sounds like another solid identification. But critics of the Warren Report circle back to what cab driver William Whaley told the Warren Commission, and that changes the story. Whaley, who had actually driven Oswald shortly after the assassination, wasn't just there to observe the lineup. He also described its setup, and it wasn't exactly confidence-inspiring. According to Whaley, the lineup Oswald was in included a group of teenagers and Oswald. Not only was Oswald noticeably older than the others, he was visibly upset, loudly accusing the police of railroading him and demanding his lawyer. Whaley would put it bluntly, quote, "Anybody who wasn't sure could have picked out the right one just for that," end quote. So was the lineup purposely unfair? Critics say yes. It was skewed from the start by mixing Oswald in with teenage boys, something that practically spotlighted him. But here's the complication. Oswald himself, through his behavior, may have unwittingly helped ID himself. Was it a rigged procedure? Or a man cracking under pressure and drawing his own heat? If you thought the lineup was already tilted against Oswald, there's more, much more. For starters, Oswald had a black eye, sustained during his arrest. None of the fillers in the lineup had one. That alone made him stand out. But it gets worse. You gotta hear this. At each lineup, the men were instructed to state their name and where they were. The police officers posing as fillers gave fake names and fictitious jobs. Oswald, he gave his real name and he said he worked at the Texas School Book Depository. By that point, nearly everyone knew that's where the police say the final shots came from. So between the black eye, the real employment, and the infamous building connection, he practically spotlighted himself. And that raises a haunting question. Were the witnesses recognizing Oswald from memory, or just connecting the dots they had been handed? So is your mind made up yet? Was Lee Harvey Oswald, or someone who looked like Oswald, the killer of J.D. Tippett? Well, you better wait and hear what we have to say in next week's episode. We'll see you then. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.